OK， 稍后。Now for a little talk, and the topic of the talk today is the significance of Buddhism in the modern world. And often people think that Buddhism perhaps is losing its significance, that it's no longer relevant because the world is changing so fast and things aren't the same as they used to be, and perhaps it's all falling apart and there's no point to Buddhism anymore. But of course, you all know that's wrong, right? Really, deep down, you know, that's not really the case. And I certainly know for myself that when I came across Buddhism and I started to read about Buddhism, I knew there was something powerful there, something wonderful there, something important, something that had to do with the very fundamentals of human life, what human life is all about, something very significant indeed. So it is. I've never had any doubt that Buddhism has, or the Dhamma maybe to be more precise, is very, very significant for human beings, or any beings for that matter. So why is it then that sometimes we worry about the significance of Buddhism? Well, first of all, an interesting thing, you look at the Western world, which is like a continuation of my own understanding of Buddhism, and you see how popular Buddhism is gradually becoming in the Western world. It's still only a small minority, but Buddhism has a very good name in the West. If you say the word Buddhism, people always think compassion, kindness, tolerance, all these positive things come to mind when you mention Buddhism. And it's not like that at all for any other religion. Buddhism like stands out as the only one which really has that very special connotation for people. So people say either I'm a Buddhist or I'm nothing at all. Everything else is really irrelevant. That's what's happening in the West. And of course, the Western world has been secularizing, in other words, become free of religion for a long time. In many countries in the West, for example, where I was born in Norway, there's only a tiny, tiny percentage that are interested in religion at all. And the vast majority of people, they are either atheists, they are agnostics, or not really interested in religion whatsoever. In a society like that, when people are not interested in religion, becomes a very materialist society. What people are interested in is, you know, the latest gadgets, the cars, the houses, all these kind of things. And very often, people feel a sense of emptiness. Surely, there must be something more to life than just running around pursuing all these things that don't really give that much satisfaction in the long run. And that is why I think that there is like an opening for a teaching like Buddhism in the West, because people recognize there must be something more in life than just pursuing these other pleasures. And that is why you look at some of the surveys that have been done in the West about people's religious preference. And there's one famous survey that was done in Sweden a number of years ago. And they asked the high school students, if everybody knew that they were all atheists, right, they weren't really interested in religion at all, but if you had to choose a religion, which one would you choose? And 60% of these high school students, 60%, 60, said that they would choose Buddhism. And that is quite amazing, isn't it? That shows you how there is that, first of all, there is a need for something, and there is an understanding that there is something beautiful in this teaching we call the Dhamma. So when people want to fill up their life, want to find meaning, Buddhism is often the place where they go. And also Buddhism fits like with the modern world view, right? It has many of the ideas of Buddhism are very to the point, to talk about psychology, how the mind works, how we can, you know, deal with the mind in a sense. Very important issues for everybody. So in the West, Buddhism has a very good name. It's still a tiny minority religion, but still, at the very least, it has a good name. And then you come to Asian countries, like perhaps Thailand or Sri Lanka, etc. And then people are full of woe. Oh, Buddhism is declining. It's all going downhill. It's not really the way it used to be in the good old days. There is never any good old days, but anyway, that's how people think. So people think, oh, in the good old days, everything was so much better. Wow, you know, if we only could get back to the purity of the way things were 20, 30, 40, 2,000, 2,500 years ago, right? And you can see why that is the case. You go, my personal experience, I don't have that much personal experience with Asian Buddhism at all, but I have a little bit with Thai Buddhism, and now I'm gaining a bit of familiarity with Buddhism here in Sri Lanka. And the picture is always the same. People are saying, oh, you know, the Sangha is getting more corrupted. You read about all these scandals in the newspapers about, you know, monks doing the wrong thing here. The number of Sangha is declining. The number of monks is going down. There's just more and more rituals being performed, amulets and all this kind of other things, which are generally considered almost superstitious in Buddhism. This is all going downhill. It's all coming to an end. What is going on with Buddhism? And I personally, I don't think Buddhism is going downhill in Asia at all. I think that's a misperception of what is happening. What is happening in Asia? Asia is going through a similar kind of change that has happened in the West as well. Where society is becoming more modernized, right? More secularized. People are thinking more for themselves. They are the worldly pursuits of the world are becoming more powerful, you know, with all the pleasures that are available, all the gadgets and all the things, the sensual pleasures coming in large amounts. And society is changing in Asian societies. In Thailand, as I think in Sri Lanka as well, the classic position of a monk was to be like the center of the local village, right? A monk would be a teacher, a monk would be a counselor, would have a very prominent place in the local society here. That is the traditional way things have been in many Asian societies for a long time. And then the modern world comes along and it says that now education will be done by the state instead, which is probably a good thing. You make sure you get good qualified teachers and all these kind of things, right? And you get counselors to help people out. And the position of the monk is changing very fast. And of course, in the modern society, there just isn't that need for a monk anymore. And then you have the temptations of the world. Why be a monk when you can go out and enjoy yourself? You can have a good time. There's so much interesting things to do in the world. The monastic life doesn't seem so interesting anymore. And that is why there is a change. That is why I think in Asian societies you're seeing something moving, something just, it's a change, and change happens all the time. And that's all it is. And it's important not to be afraid of change, but to embrace it and accept it for what it is and ask ourselves, how can we use that change to become stronger again in the Buddha's teachings? And this is what I suspect is going to happen in the long run. Out of the change, out of the apparent decline, it's not a real decline, it's an apparent decline, there will be renewal. There always is renewal as well when you have changed. And that renewal will be a deeper appreciation of the Buddha's teachings, a deeper appreciation of what they really are about, what we should do with our life, keep, you know, actually practicing these teachings rather than just listening to sermons or talks, rather than just reading, actually practicing them and getting somewhere. The monastic Sangha maybe will go more back to its roots because it isn't really needed anymore for teaching, right, and these kind of things. So the monastic Sangha will perhaps then go back to its roots, emphasize meditation practice, emphasize the virtue, emphasize the wisdom. And that is what I see is very likely outcome of the modernization of Buddhism in Asia. That's a wonderful opportunity. It is more significant than ever before if you look at it this way. And that is why it is so powerful. So what then is the significance of the Buddha's teachings? Why is it so important? And why is it so ever relevant? Why is it that it speaks to people across cultures, across time, you know, it is just as important now as it was at the time of the Buddha. How can that be that something is so stable and so stably significant? What is the reason for that? And the reason for that, in my mind, is that Buddhism speaks to something very deep inside of us. And what Buddhism really is to me the answer to the very meaning of life. That is why it's important. If something is the answer to the meaning of life, what else could possibly matter, right? This is it. You don't have to go any further. You find the solution to the meaning of life. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing if that were true? I think it is true, and this is why. Sometimes when you are young, it was certainly the case when I was young, in my teen years, late teenager, whatever, I often contemplated this idea of the meaning of life. Why am I here? What is the purpose of this? Because when you're a teenager, you're thinking about the future, right? You're thinking about what kind of education should I have? What kind of job would I like? What kind of partner should I have in life? Should I be an atheist? Should I have a religion, perhaps? All of these things, you're questioning a lot when you're a teenager. And one of those questions, which is like the question behind all questions, is what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? What is my peace in this big world that is lying there in front of me? And sometimes when we consider the meaning of life, we consider the external world. We think, is the whole world moving towards a better place where everybody is kind and compassionate to each other? Do I have a personal kind of importance in this world? It is often like that. We all feel a bit self-important, right? We always think, do I have an important place in this world? Maybe I have some kind of special significance in this big world. I must do my job and do the right thing. Yeah. It's all coming from the sense of self. Or maybe the whole world is going towards something important. And that has to do often with the idea of a God, right? If there's a God, it makes sense that the world should have some kind of purpose. If there is no God, then it is far from obvious that there is a purpose to the world. So this is how we often think. And it's the wrong way, I think, to look at the meaning of life. You will never find it by looking outside of yourself, by looking at where the world is going. To find the meaning of life, you have to turn inside of yourself. Look inside. Now, what do you see when you look inside? What you see when you look inside are all these desires, all these cravings, all these aims, all these things that we want to do, which are always pushing us forward in a certain direction, pushing us forward to this, pushing us forward to that. Now look at those desires. What do those desires promise you? And what I find when I look into myself, I see all these desires always pushing me this way and that way. I see that these desires, they are saying, if you do this, then you will be satisfied. If you do that, you will feel content. If you did do this, then there will be no more craving after this, because then you will be happy. That is what craving is telling you. And that is why you're always pursuing it. Or most people are always pursuing it. Because we think there will be some real happiness and contentment once you reach the object of that craving. So that is, there is where you start to see the purpose in life. What we really all want. The craving never gives us what we actually want. It never supplies what it tells us it will supply. But that yearning inside for contentment, for peace, for a sense of happiness, for a sense of being fulfilled, for being complete inside. Not having craving is a sense of lack of completion, right? You want something more. You don't feel fulfilled. This is what we really want. This is what we want to head towards. That is the meaning of life. So the meaning of life is found inside. This movement is trying to reach a sense of completion, fulfillment, basically happiness. And of course, then you come to the Buddha's teachings, right? You understand that the meaning of life is to find a sense of true happiness. You come to the Buddha's teaching, and the first thing the Buddha says, there is suffering, which means there is happiness as well. Suffering and happiness are the opposite sides of the same coin. So there you have a teaching which matches the very yearning of the human heart. You have understood where the meaning of life must lie, and then you find a teaching which supplies the answer to that very yearning. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Isn't that powerful? And then you read the Buddha's teaching, and straight away, maybe not straight away, but after reading a bit, you recognize that, yes, this does actually provide that very answer. There is something very profound here, something very meaningful. And it is going to lead to precisely this fulfillment that I'm searching for inside. So how does it do that? How does the Dhamma lead to that sense of fulfillment? And there is a number of ways you can look at this. But if you take as your start point the idea of the craving inside. Now, what is the problem with always pursuing sensual desires? What is the problem with that? The problem is, there are manifold problems, but one problem is that you pursue a sensual desire. You pursue getting a new car, right? And then you get the new car, and it's very exciting in the beginning. You know, it's shiny and new. It drives very fast. You've got all these new instrument panels inside. You get very excited by your new car. And it's great fun. That great fun lasts how long? 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. And then the car starts to be not so much fun anymore, right? And not long after that, you start looking at the next model. Maybe I could improve a little bit on this car. It isn't perfect. It isn't as good as I want, right? So craving arises. You pursue the object. You attain the object. And that satisfaction that craving promised you soon turns into more craving in the future. New craving, renewed again and again. So it isn't as if we get satisfied at all. It's just renews, and sometimes the new craving is even stronger than the previous one. And sometimes we feel a little bit less happy because we realize somehow deep inside that this is not really working here. It's not functioning here. Or take some of the great happinesses in human life. Finding a partner who you really love and who really is close to you, and you feel you find kind of somebody wonderful. And when we are in love with somebody, you feel so high and you feel so great, right? And gradually, that happiness of being in love, it comes down and down and down. And then when it comes down, eventually, it comes down to the same place you were before you were in love. Back to the same place again. Nothing has really happened. What a disappointment. All that craving, all that pursuit, all that thing, looking for this, and it doesn't actually work. It doesn't get you anywhere. And this is one of the problems with sensual desire. You start at a certain level of happiness. You pursue the object. You get a little bit of happiness when you reach the goal of that object. Then it comes down again. And you are exactly where you started. Right? You know what I mean? And this is not just my idea, but this has been shown by various psychological studies that this is actually the case. You tend always to come back to the baseline where you were before. You get a little bit of happiness from getting that nice meal, from getting a new house, from a relationship or whatever, and then you go back to the baseline again. Not going anywhere. Nothing is really happening. And because of that, the craving arises again, right? And every time the craving arises again, the same thing happens. Nothing is really happening. Nothing works. Not actually going anywhere. And then you have the same thing with the negative side. The negative side of craving is you get a bit depressed, perhaps. You get sad because somebody in your life has died. And when you get sad, sometimes we feel terrible and it feels like the sadness is going to last forever. But all the research shows that after a while, the sadness starts to disappear. The happiness comes back and you're back on the same level you were before. And this is the sensual worldview. And that is one reason why it doesn't work. Because you're not getting anywhere. And then you come to the end of your life and you've been going up and down like this yo-yo for, 80 years or whatever. You come to the end of your life, and if you're lucky, you are just where you started. If you're not so lucky, you're lower than where you started. Right? And you look back and you think, why? What was the purpose of all that? And this is the problem of life. You do all these things that don't really have a purpose. It doesn't take you anywhere. So this is one of the problems with pursuit of sensual pleasures. But there's many, many more problems with the pursuit of sensual pleasures. Another problem with the pursuit of sensual pleasures is look inside of you when you are pursuing these things. Look inside of you when you are chasing after more money, when you are chasing after a new relationship, when you're chasing after whatever it is. And you will see that always, together with that chase, together with that desire, the going after things, there's always is a sense of craving inside, right? What is that craving? It's a sense of restlessness. It's a sense of agitation, a sense of not being satisfied. It's not a very beautiful state, right? It's this feeling of always moving towards something, not being happy where you are. That is another reason, a very important reason, why sensual pleasures is not really all that happy. So how does this change when we look at the pleasures and the happiness of the Dhamma instead? And this, we're not talking about the meaning of life, right? So how is that different? So what is that, first of all, what is that pleasure of the Dhamma? How does it actually arise? And it arises in many different ways. But one of the ways, and one of the most important ways that the pleasure of the Dhamma arises, is when you have a good heart, when you are a good person, you keep your sila, you are kind and compassionate to the world, you are generous, and you basically you are a blessing to yourself and the world around you. How do you feel when you do that? And you feel, if you look carefully, if you practice like this over a long time, you feel a sense of gladness inside of you. You feel it's natural, it happens by itself. And this is one of my, please excuse me, this is one of my favorite similes from the suttas, from the word of the Buddha. And it shows you how the Buddha explained how you feel if you are a good person. And the Buddha says, when a good person comes home in the evening after having finished their day's work, etc., and they sit down or they lie down and they just feel a sense of peace and relax, the way they feel when they do that, they feel a sense of gladness. They don't have to do anything in particular. They just feel glad because they have a good heart. That is all. And the Buddha said, it's just like a mountain, a big mountain in the evening time, and the sun is about to set behind that mountain. And when the sun sets behind that enormous mountain, then the land in front of the mountain becomes completely enveloped and covered by the shadow of that mountain. The sun goes behind, and the shadow of the mountain covers everything. And it's just like that for the good person. The person who is virtuous, kind, has a good heart, it's exactly the same. The goodness comes back to you, it envelops you, it covers you, and it surrounds you on all sides. So you have to feel happy. You have no choice. Great, isn't that wonderful? You have no choice but to feel happy. What could be more wonderful than that? It just comes back to you as a matter of course. Nothing you have to do. You don't even have to think about your past actions. There's a sense of purity inside of you. It's one of my favorite suttas, similes rather, in the suttas of the Buddha, because it shows you something very profound and beautiful about this practice of the Dhamma. Now, what is it about that happiness? How is that different from the sensual happiness of the world? And the way it is different, if you look inside of yourself at that time, it is a peaceful happiness. There is no craving associated with it. There's no agitation. There's no restlessness. And that is one reason why it is so beautiful. You feel a real, it's a deep sense of contentment, a sense of fulfillment, right? Craving is looking for something more. Now you are not craving. You're not seeking for something more. You feel fulfilled inside. You feel complete inside. And that is why this happiness is so beautiful. So that is the happiness that the Dhamma promises you if you live a good life. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And then you start, when you start to see that, you really starts to have an effect on you. So contemplate that. Look at that in your own life. Understand how it actually works. When you understand how it works, when you can see it in your own mind, it becomes so powerful. It becomes so beautiful. It drives you in the right direction. And of course, that's only the beginning, right? That's only the very beginning. The sense of satisfaction you have from being virtuous like that is only a little bit. And then your meditation starts to take off, and the sense of satisfaction becomes much deeper. So you can then start to like extrapolate, you can extend that into the future. If I keep practicing like this, it's going to be even better. It's going to be even more powerful. And the degree of happiness, of contentment, of peace, of fulfillment, of completeness that is available in the Dhamma is so profound. It goes so far. It is so enormous. And this is what you have to look forward to. So check this out inside of yourself. Understand what is going on. Understand why this is beautiful. And then you will be moving on the right path. So this is one reason, a very, very important reason, why the spiritual life is so worthwhile. And the pursuing of material happiness is okay. But get your priorities right. Remember what is really important. Don't be immoral because you're pursuing the material goods make sure you have your priorities right. The goodness of the heart must come first. And then within that framework, you then pursue the material things of the world. So that is the first thing about sensual pleasures and spiritual happiness. And the other thing I was just mentioning before is how the pursuit of sensual pleasures always goes up and down, right? And you're never really getting anywhere. You always come back to the place you were before. It's not actually working. With spiritual happiness, it's different. With spiritual happiness, when you do something good, sometimes you have a little bit of a peak of happiness. You know, you do something spontaneously, a kind act towards somebody, and you feel a spontaneous sense of happiness inside, of joy, because you've done something good. That's like a peak, just like before. But when that peak comes down, it leaves an impact in the mind, an imprint in the mind, and you feel a little bit more happy than you did before. You're lifting yourself up. You're building yourself up. The mind is becoming lighter. You're cutting the moorings. The moorings are like the badness, you know, the immorality in your life. You're cutting those moorings that are holding you down, cutting the anchors, and allows you to soar. And the mind soars, the mind becomes light, the mind becomes beautiful. And then when you live your life, as time goes by, it goes up and up and up like that. And then when time comes for your death, you are in a different place from where you were when you started off, when you came into this world. And then when you look back upon your life, you see, I have lived a good life. I have done what was worthwhile. I have fulfilled the meaning of life, at least in part. I have gone somewhere. I have done something useful. And then, of course, you die with that contentment. You die in a beautiful way. And then that leads to even more happiness in the future. It all goes in the right direction. So this is why the spiritual life is important. Because it answers the very yearning in the human heart. The yearning for true fulfillment, true completeness, true happiness, true contentment, true peace that we all have inside of us. We think that we will find this in sensual pleasures, but you can't find it in sensual pleasures. It can only be found through spiritual practice, practice of the Dhamma in the right way. And that is why the Dhamma is always significant. It doesn't matter how many sensual pleasures you have in the world. It doesn't matter how many gadgets you have, iPhones, iPads, Kindles, computers, internet, all this stuff. In fact, often it just gives rise to more suffering, doesn't it? All these kind of things. But it doesn't matter how much that stuff you have, because in the end, you realize the limitations of those things. True happiness is to be found somewhere else. Contemplate that. Think about that, because this is the essence, the foundation of the spiritual life. So, Buddha Dhamma is never going to be insignificant. It is always going to be significant. But it is for people with an inquiring mind. People who actually look at the world in a realistic way and try to find, you know, out what should I be doing with my life? What is right? What is wrong? It's for that kind of people. So it is always, in a sense, going to be a minority pursuit. Don't be surprised if many people here in Sri Lanka convert to other religions. It's okay, it doesn't matter. It's not about number in Buddhism, it's about quality. It's about quality, about understanding what this is really about. So don't be too concerned about people converting. It doesn't matter, as long as those people who practice the Dhamma do it in the right way. So, Buddhism is very significant. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a completely different aspect as well. It ties in with this one, of course, because all aspects of the Dhamma tie together. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle, and all the pieces fit together very nicely and very beautifully here. And that aspect I want to talk about is some of the things that has happened in Buddhism in the modern world. Some of the things, some of the research in particular that has happened, which has significant consequences for our understanding of the Buddha's teaching. And this particular thing, which I have been involved in a little bit myself, is called something called comparative studies of the Dhamma. And what it means is basically comparing the teaching of the Buddha as we have it from different places, different languages, etc. Now, to understand how this works, it is important to look a little bit back at Buddhist history and remember Buddhist history a little bit. So Buddhist history, after the time of the Buddha, that was a time when the Dhamma was very... the Sangha and people were all collected in one community, just Buddhism, just Dhamma, right? And that's when all the suttas were put together in the Tipitaka, and it was all collected nicely together. And that's why we still have the Tipitaka in the present day. But then not so long after the Buddha, during the time of the great Indian Emperor Ashoka, at that time Buddhism started to divide, and you got different sects in Buddhism. You got certain sects that went to the north of India, and those sects are called like the Sarvastivadins and the Dharmaguptakas. They went to the north of India. There were all the other sects of Buddhism, like the Mahasanghikas, etc. They stayed in central India. And of course, there was the Theravadins, or they can go by different names, who came to Sri Lanka with the Arahant Mahinda, right? Mahinda came to Sri Lanka with Buddhism roughly at the time of Ashoka. And this is not just belief, this history has been shown also through archaeological excavations and also by inscriptions, etc. We can be fairly certain that this actually is a historical fact, that Buddhism divided in this way, and different sects were established in different parts of India and also Sri Lanka at about that time. Now, when Buddhism starts to spread out like that, because the distances are so enormous, the distance from Sri Lanka, from here in Colombo, to Kashmir, for example, in north of India, I have looked at the map, it's about 3,000 kilometers. 3,000 kilometers is a long way. It's not so long now because you can go by plane, but at the time of the Buddha, it was a very, very long way. Basically, you had to walk, right? So there wasn't very much interaction. So these schools then tended to pursue the Dhamma in slightly different ways. The Sarvastivadins who were in Kashmir, the Dharmaguptakas who were in what is now Pakistan and Afghanistan, they developed new scriptures that went in one way. Whereas the Theravadins in Sri Lanka, they developed other scriptures that went in a slightly different way. And this is how Buddhism started to become more diversified. You got different sects, different schools of Buddhism, and they all went in slightly different directions. Then the Sarvastivadins, because they were quite close to China, if you come to Kashmir, it is still a few thousand kilometers to China, but it's much closer than Sri Lanka, right? So because they were relatively close, the Dhamma would follow the Silk Road. The Silk Road is the famous trade route that goes through Central Asia. The Dhamma would follow the Silk Road from Kashmir and then go from there into China. And that is how Buddhism first came to China, roughly around 400 or 500 years after the Buddha. That's when it started to seep into China. And of course there it was translated into Chinese, right? And because it was translated into Chinese, today we have the equivalent of the Pali Nikayas. You now have also in Chinese. They're called the Agamas in Chinese. That word Agama also exists in the Pali language. Sometimes it's used instead of Nikaya, but there it is always called the Agamas. And then there were suttas that were preserved in Central Asia, and they were translated into Sanskrit. So some suttas are found in Sanskrit. Other suttas have been discovered in many other Indian languages, Gandhari, the various types of Prakrits. Prakrits are just different versions of Indian languages. They exist in all these various forms. And also some in Tibetan, and some into Central Asian languages. Some of them have some strange names, Khotanese, Sogdian, these are Central Asian languages. So what has happened in recent times? That people with great skills in languages, they have taken these various sources and put them together and started to compare them. So you take a very important scripture in the Pali Canon, like the Majjhima Nikaya, and you compare the suttas, the word of the Buddha, in the Majjhima Nikaya, you compare that with the Majjhima Nikaya or equivalent suttas in all these other languages. That's what you do. And then when you do that, when you compare the Pali Majjhima Nikaya with a Chinese version of the Majjhima Nikaya called the Madhyama Agama, what do you find? What do you think you find? Do you think you find a vast difference that in one place the Buddha says A, in the other one he says X, and there's no comparison whatsoever? Is that what you find? No, it's not what you find. What you find, this is so interesting, when you do these comparative studies and you look at the basic suttas of Buddhism, they are almost exactly the same. Remember, these schools, they divided at the time of Ashoka. Ashoka lived about 2,250 years ago, almost 2,300 years ago now. 2,300 years, that's an incredibly long time, right? They have been apart for that long. And now, when you compare them, they are almost exactly the same. There are small differences. Sometimes, like the setting, you know, where the sutta was spoken might be different. The initial narrative, the end of the sutta might be slightly different. But the doctrine, the actual teaching of the Buddha, the most important things, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Spiritual Faculties, the Bodhisattvas, dependent origination, all the core teaching of Buddhism as we have them, are often not only same, but word for word identical after 2,300 years. That is an amazing thing, and it's absolutely astonishing. So those things that are so similar in the Buddha's teaching after so much time, that must be the core teaching that goes back to the time of the Buddha himself. The very fact that they have been preserved so well for 2,300 years makes it extremely likely that they were preserved at least as well for the 150 years before that. That takes you back to the time of the Buddha himself. So what these comparative studies shows us, in case we had any doubt, there are many other reasons too for believing that the Pali Canon is the word of the Buddha. But what this shows us is that we do, in fact, have the very word of the Buddha himself in this present day. That is what this shows us. I think, personally, some people, there's always going to be some people who doubt these things and who throw, you know, spanners in the works. But for me, it is just so obvious that this must be the case. It is the only rational explanation for this enormous similarity after so much time. And isn't that wonderful to open the suttas? And it's not as if you don't know what you're reading. You are reading, literally, the word of the Buddha himself. This great master, this incredible meditator who existed 2,500 years ago. It gives you a direct link to the Buddha. You become his disciples when you read this suttas. You are there. It's as if you're there listening to him on that occasion. And I always like to think about the Buddha, the master of wisdom, the master of compassion. When he taught the discourses 2,400, 2,500 years ago, he not only did he teach the people who were around him, but he knew when he taught those discourses that there would be people in the future, like here today, or like maybe not so much here today, because I'm not really talking directly from the suttas, I'm more talking around it. But there will be people in 2,500 years, in 3,000 years, whatever, who will be listening to the same suttas. That's why he spoke them in such a clear way. That's why he used such non-technical language. That's why he spoke across time and across culture so beautifully. So the Buddha had us in mind when he taught those suttas 2,500 years ago. Isn't that a nice thought? The Buddha, this great master, he thought about us when he taught those suttas. Think about that. It makes you very happy when you think about that. And when you are reading the suttas, there you are. You are in direct contact with the Buddha. He is teaching you directly as he thought about you 2,500 years ago. So, that is my little talk today. And so my conclusion is that Buddhism is incredibly significant. It couldn't be more significant than it is, because it relates to the very meaning of human life. So thank you very much.